Welcome to Afternoon Light, the podcast at the Robert Menzies Institute, hosted by Georgina Downer. Hello, and on today's episode of Afternoon Light, I am joined by James Cotton, who is an emeritus professor at UNSW Canberra and the author of The Australians at Geneva, Internationalist Diplomacy in the Interwar Years. And it's a pleasure to have you with me today, James.
Thank you, Georgina.
And you've written such a fascinating book on a researched, under, talked about period, the interwar years between World War I and World War II, and what Australians were doing, well, basically the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations. I thought we'd start our discussion, James, for the benefit of those who don't know too much about the League of Nations, repairing that wrong, and maybe you could explain what was the League of Nations? How did it come about?
Well, at the end of the Great War, as a condition of the peace settlement, President Woodrow Wilson insisted that there be a new international organization devoted to achieving peace and security, bringing in diverse a group of nations as possible, diffusing the accustomed arguments of Europe, but also bringing the Americans into the story. For various reasons, the British also had ideas about post-war organisation that weren't too far away from Wilson's ideas. The French weren't particularly happy with Wilson, but were pretty well required to accept his prescription. That's how we got the League of Nations. Now, by comparison with the United Nations, it's an extremely modest organisation, very slim finances, and of course, major countries didn't join, most notably the United States. But in so many ways, the League of Nations was a precursor to the United Nations that it's kind of safe to say it's UN 1.0. The difference, of course, is that at the end of the Second War, it had to be a new organization, first of all, because there'd been huge American opposition to joining the League, and so it had to be a fresh canvas to sell it to the American people. But also, of course, the Russians, having joined late, actually got expelled for invading Finland in 1940. So it had to be a fresh organization so that they could be members too. But in many ways, there's huge continuity, and significant bits of the UN actually started life as agencies of the League.
The League of Nations, to me, first came into my consciousness, of course, through the Frank Morehouse series with Edith Campbell Berry as the protagonist leading the charge as part of the delegation from Australia to the brand new League of Nations as it was. Australia has quite an interesting and undertold story at the League of Nations, which of course is the topic of your book. But it starts off, doesn't it, with Australia's Prime Minister at the time signing as party to the Treaty of Versailles. Billy Hughes has his own views on Australia's place in the world and what this organisation can achieve. How did he conceive of the League, do you think?
Well, Billy Hughes never had a very high estimate of the League, and he's on record as making some extremely mordant remarks about it in later years. But if he was able to achieve some particular objectives in the Paris peace talks, then he was prepared to go along with the League. And the objective that he was particularly after was to acquire a former German New Guinea. And he wanted to acquire it solely for the reason of strategic denial. Originally, his intention was, of course, to annex it outright, but it was simply impossible to do that with any of the conquered territories of the former antagonists in the war. So, better than nothing at all, it was a League mandate. But very cleverly, it was what was called a Class C mandate, which, under the rules of the League, set up a system of administration that pretty well allowed the mandatory power to practice its own domestic laws in that territory. And that suited Hughes very well. This was an idea, actually, that was partly invented by John Latham, who was one of Hughes' staff at the Paris peace talks. So Hughes achieved that major strategic objective, and he also made sure that there were no compromising statements in the foundation documents of the League, and in particular, he was vociferous in rejecting Japan's attempt to introduce into the preamble to the League a statement about racial equality, because he could see this as being the thin edge of the wedge regarding the White Australia policy, and he was determined to defend that. But in all, I think Hughes went along with the League because he managed to achieve these particular objectives, but he was no proponent of the League. There were some later prime ministers who were actually quite keen on the League, but not Hughes.
In terms of the White Australia policy, did that factor in any of the relationships Australia was managing during the negotiations around the League? I mean, you obviously have concerns around Japan trying to put in clauses that would have perhaps made the White Australia policy difficult to defend, but did it cause frictions between Australia and other countries?
Well, it did cause frictions, but Australia was really only a minor player because in the United States by this time, Japanese immigration was completely prohibited by statute. And so President Wilson was hardly likely to accept any condition in the League Foundation documents that would allow Japan to use the League as a platform for criticising this exclusionary policy. So Wilson was quite happy for Hughes to make the running, but Wilson was equally concerned to head off this attempt, as indeed were the Canadians, who also had legislation prohibiting Japanese immigration.
Australia's involvement in the League of Nations is notable, particularly for the fact that it was really the first time we were granted representation as a full member independent of Britain. And this was the case for other dominions like Canada, Irish Free State, New Zealand and South Africa. So can you tell me what that meant for Australia's sense of independence, internationally speaking?
In the book, I suggest that membership of the League was like joining a school for international citizenship. Because up until that time, yes, we had many dealings beyond our borders, but the dealings beyond our borders generally were either with members of the British Community of Nations in one form or another, or we were sometimes dealing with foreign countries, but often it was by way of the Colonial Office and the Foreign Office. So when we joined the League, although the British were the largest source of budgetary support for the League and the British were probably the most important players in the League, nevertheless, we found ourselves exposed to situations where foreign countries, for one reason or another, whether it was trade or issues like conduct in the mandatory territories, we had to justify our conduct and justify our policies to countries with which we hadn't had otherwise consistent relations at all. And so we spent quite a few years learning how to deal with those issues. Of course, generally speaking, our conduct in the League was refracted through the British lens, usually when we sent our annual delegates to the League of Nations Assembly. These delegates would first caucus with the British and the Dominion's representatives so that there'd be no inconsistencies in the policies that were followed. But we did find ourselves from time to time, particularly, like I say, those particular issues where we had to account for ourselves on our own terms. Probably the most important issue was conduct of policy in New Guinea. Every 2 years, we had to go before the Permanent Mandates Commission, was an independent body of experts whose role was to assess our conduct in the mandatory territory, because we'd signed on to an agreement that our job was to improve the conditions of life of the inhabitants and to progressively introduce them to enlightened policies in education and health and so forth. But that was our principal responsibility. Every year we had to produce a report on our conduct of government in New Guinea. And like I say, every 2 years we had to front up and sometimes be at the receiving end of some very searching questions on what we'd been up to. And the Permanent Mandates Commission were quite well briefed. There were even people in Australia who would be sending them newspaper articles about deeds or misdeeds in New Guinea. And so sometimes they were extremely well informed. Sometimes, of course, they were probably over-impressed by sensationalist accounts that they found in the popular press, but sometimes they were able to ask very searching questions. For example, in 1929, there was something called the Rabaul Revolt, and for a period of time there was a campaign in Rabaul on the part of Indigenous workers for higher wages, and it led to strikes in a number of sectors. Well, this was reported in the Australian newspapers. Those reports went to Geneva, and when we got up in front of the Permanent Mandates Commission in 1929, we had to explain ourselves. And in fact, the Permanent Mandates Commission was so unimpressed with our performance that they said, we won't receive your report this year until you come up with a whole lot more information about what you've done about this state of affairs. So this was a novel experience. There were no British officials or political figures there to intercede for us. We had to account for ourselves on our own terms. And so in some ways, like I say, this was an absolutely formative experience in learning to be an international citizen.
And reputationally, how did that play for Australia overseeing the mandate of New Guinea?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it. One way is to say, oh, well, Permanent Mandates Commission was really a kind of club for imperialists, and so none of these criticisms were going to be too searching. But the other way of looking at it is to compare our conduct in Papua with our conduct in New Guinea. In fact, we devoted a whole lot more attention to what we did in New Guinea. There was a whole lot more transparency in our policy, and from time to time we made changes and introduced reforms that we wouldn't otherwise have introduced had it not been for the scrutiny of the Permanent Mandates Commission. So looking at it in the longer term, so actually our policy was considerably improved by the fact that we had to explain it in Geneva.
Australia was represented at the League by the High Commissioner in London, so they weren't located in Geneva where the League of Nations was. But did that give a sense that it was the League of Nations was considered a second order issue from the Empire and the High Commissioner, and it was for a long time, of course, former Prime Minister Stanley Bruce, was more focused on Empire affairs and relationship with Britain than really their secondary job representing Australia at the League of Nations?
Now, that's a fair observation. The leader of the delegation wasn't always the High Commissioner. Sometimes other people took charge. Jim Scullin, when he was Prime Minister, was the leader of the delegation to the League, but only briefly.
And because he was en route to the Imperial Conference in London.
He was en route to the 1930 Imperial Conference. John Latham was head of the delegation 1 year when he was Attorney General. So it wasn't always the High Commissioner, but very often it was the High Commissioner. But of course, particularly when Bruce became High Commissioner, he was Minister without portfolio in London from 1932 and High Commissioner from 1933, Bruce became quite a presence in Geneva, and he was often in Geneva. And in fact, a number of contemporary observers rated Bruce as an exceptionally capable League chairman. He even became, for a time, chair of the League of Nations Council, the equivalent of what is now the United Nations Security Council, when Australia became a member of that council. And famously presided over a meeting devoted to discussing the German reoccupation of the Rhineland in 1936. So, yes, it's absolutely true that League matters were of a lesser importance than Empire matters, but one has to appreciate, too, that in terms of the discourse of the time, the League and the Empire Commonwealth, as it was then called, were institutions which, for a lot of people anyway, were organised along similar principles and were mainly aiming at the same objectives. And in fact, it goes all the way back to Jan Christian Smuts in his original proposal that was incorporated in Wilson's plan for the League, which became the Covenant. Smuts said that Empire Commonwealth has pioneered the idea of a group of self-governing countries coming together and formulating a single approach to the major issues in the world. If we can recreate on a global scale the practices that have been so successful in the Empire Commonwealth, then the League will do very well. So there are a lot of progressive thinkers thought there wasn't a whole lot of difference between the Empire Commonwealth and the League of Nations. And in fact, some people even said, oh, the thing that gives the foreign policy of the Empire Commonwealth countries a unity is the fact that they all affirm the major principles of the League. So they put the League first as a way of understanding how it was that the Empire Commonwealth countries stood together.
During that period, obviously, this sense of Wilsonian, you know, liberal internationalism was gaining great traction, obviously not within the US Senate, and they prevented the US becoming a member of the League of Nations. But in Australia, how did that strand of liberal internationalism take root intellectually, or was there still a great deal of scepticism about it?
Well, by the standards of the period before the Great War, the League was responsible for engendering a much wider appreciation of international affairs in Australia. During the First War in Britain, we have the origins of what became the League of Nations Union. The League of Nations Union in Britain became a kind of major pressure group, encouraging the country to stick to the principles of the Covenant and carry on financing the League organisations. In Australia, we had our own League of Nations Union. First of all, it was a state-based organisation, then it became a federal organisation in 1930. And The League of Nations Union was usually, its patron was the Prime Minister, it had churchmen, it had federal ministers on its board. It was an organisation that was both a pressure group, but also a very broad church devoted to the idea of informing Australians about their international obligations and about Australia's place inside international institutions. So the League of Nations Union, important body in understanding the generation of informed opinion in Australia in those years. There's a considerable amount of overlap, though, between membership of that organisation, membership of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, which gets off the ground 1923, 1924, becomes a federal organisation in 1933, and also the Roundtable Group, which was a group that was devoted to Empire-Commonwealth relations. But as I say, because a lot of progressive thinkers thought there wasn't a whole lot of difference between the League and the Empire-Commonwealth, so these people too thought that they were devoted to the same broad role. And so I think whereas pre-war, pre-First War, you can say there were Imperial Federationists and there were various other kinds of groups. On the far left, there were kind of radical internationalists, but these opinion groups were very small. Between the wars, I think you can see that there was quite a lot of work done towards making Australians aware of their place in the world. And a lot of press evidence of this, some of it I cite in the book, because these organisations were quite good, not just at intellectual tasks, but also they were very good at publicising. There were international pageants. There were all kinds of events organised to get people to focus on Australia's place in the world. So I think we can say that really interwar, there's the beginning of that consciousness, and the League was crucial for its development.
A lot of the focus of your book, of course, is in the contributions that individual Australians made to League affairs, and that's particularly as it relates to non-peace related matters like labour, drug control, people trafficking, global health issues. And it's interesting, a lot of those issues remain to this day the effective parts of really are the international organisations that exist to this day. Can you give me a sense of the individuals' contributions? I know you talk a lot about William Caldwell, Raymond Kershaw, and Duncan Hall as the sort of key figures who Australians should know more about to this day.
Well, I have to say, just to take one step back perhaps, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I'd be doing other work on the interwar period. I was well aware of Frank Moorhouse's books, but it seemed to me that his premise was wrong. I remember him saying, I've been to a number of presentations he's given in the past, Edith Campbell-Berry, I had to use a Canadian original because there were no Australians. And of course, I was well aware that there were Australians at the League, and the more work I did, the more I uncovered. Now, these three people spent long years working in the Secretariat, one in the ILO, which of course is a part of the League of Nations system, two in the Secretariat proper. And all three of them both had quite an impact on the way the League functioned, but also they had quite an impact on Australian opinion because they all came to Australia repeatedly. They were on missions to Australia, and their work had a considerable impact even on particular Australian policy, as I show in the book. But the other thing I wanted to look at in the book was in particular to look at a lot of the women who went to Geneva, because there was a very considerable contingent of women, Australian women, who in various capacities made a considerable contribution. First of all, of course, in the rules of the League, there's the famous Article 7, which says that no post in the League shall be closed to women. Women should have an equal role in staffing and contributing to the League. And so a lot of progressive women saw the Geneva institutions would be a way to enlarge the possibilities open to them in their own countries. And Australian women were in the forefront of this movement. And so I follow the careers of a number of Australian women in the book, just showing how they managed to do that. From 1922, and Billy Hughes was responsible for introducing this change, it was always the case that the delegations to the annual General Assembly of the countries of the League, generally held in September of every year, these delegations would include at least one woman. And there's an enormous amount of documentation on the lobbying that women made, first of all, to make sure that appropriate people were sent to Geneva, and secondly, that the government took seriously some of the objectives that various groups of which they were members espoused. We could talk about a number of these objectives. Probably the most important of all was gender equality in citizenship. And this was an important issue in the interwar period. period, because under the rules of the time, as far as many countries were concerned, if you married, you acquired the nationality of your husband and you lost your own nationality. Now, there was a convention in The Hague held to discuss this issue in 1930, and the rules of the international system were codified to liberalise them somewhat. But this was not good enough as far as Australian women were concerned. They wanted to have gender equality in citizenship. And they spoke on this issue consistently in Geneva and lobbied the government, spent a lot of time and energy lobbying the government to try and have this reform introduced. There were a whole lot of other women's issues also. And of course, latterly, in the 30s, peace and security became a major focus because a number of women's groups were particularly focused on the move towards war and what could be done to try and deflect that movement. But the other group of people I was interested in were some of the women who worked in the secretariat. And again, you see Edith Campbell Berry in Frank Moorhouse's book. She works in the secretariat. And as I say, she's based on a Canadian original. But now I discovered a number of women who worked in the secretariat, and family historians and others were able to fill in all kinds of gaps in the record, which heretofore hasn't really been properly explored. If I could just take one example, there was a very interesting lady called Amelia Hernier, and she was a very early employee of the League secretariat. She was born in Holland of British and Dutch parentage. She had a French stepfather and she was educated in France. She came to Australia before the First War and had an amazingly adventurous life, but we don't have time to talk about that. But she did go back to Europe. She did work at the League for quite a period of time and a colourful personality. Now, I can't vouch for this story because it was told to me by her grandson, who was very helpful in providing all kinds of documentation about Amelia. But the story goes that her mother was an exotic dancer.
Oh.
And in fact, I've seen a photograph of her mother. And yes, I think she was, you could say that that was an accurate description. Her stepfather was a pastry cook. And he was supposedly a pastry cook in the hotel next door to the Moulin Rouge. And as a young girl, Amelia sat on the knee of Toulouse-Lautrec and pulled his beard. Now, Frank Moorhouse would have made that an entire chapter, if not indeed the first part of the book. It seemed to me rather a pity, the fact that, you know, Australians like that, here they were working in the League, making a contribution to this international organisation, and that they're quite forgotten. There were two other women who were amongst the very earliest employees of the League. There was a lady called Ella Doyle, who worked on and off in Geneva all the way through the interwar period. And even after the war, also did some work for the International Labour Organization. So, yeah, there are a whole number of Australian women. And, of course, these days, history is not simply just about the official delegates and the leaders, but it's about all of the people, because all of the people make the organizations. And it's really important to realize that, yes, we were playing our part. I mean, nothing like, of course, for example, there were some hundreds of Italians working in the ILO. Wonderful book by a lady called Elisabetta Tolado. It's detailed the Italian contribution of the League. We can't tell that kind of story, but I think it's important to realise we did at least write a chapter.
Duncan Hall, who you write about, he actually met Robert Menzies when he was Attorney General and visiting London in 1935. And there were discussions, of course, at the time, not just in Australia, across the UK and other places, about appeasement of Nazi Germany. And at that time, Menzies, like others in Australia, was in favour of appeasement. I mean, people had experienced, of course, World War I, the war to end all wars. There was no appetite for spilling more Australian blood on foreign soil in defence of Europe. Obviously, that was to come. And Hall was trying to change Menzies' mind on appeasement. He was obviously incredibly concerned with what he saw happening in Europe, and he obviously saw that firsthand based in Geneva. Can you describe why he came to that view?
Well, I think Hall could see the coming catastrophe, as indeed many people could. He'd worked at the League since 1927, but he'd been interested in international relations for as long as his career was running. But interestingly enough, later on he became quite a close friend of Menzies. When he came to Australia in the 50s to research his enormous book on the Commonwealth, which was eventually published in 1971. By that stage, was so friendly with Menzies that Menzies ordered all of the documents that he wished to see should be delivered to him, and that he be given a desk in what was then East Block, and he was even allowed to use the ASIO tea room, because ASIO were also in that building. And then later on, when Hall's big book came out, Menzies wrote a very fulsome preface describing what a wonderful scholar Hall was. But yes, in the 30s, Hall had fallen under the spell of the psychoanalytic movement, and it obviously read Civilization and its Discontents. And he'd met Freud, and he was worried that, in particular, the German political system had adopted some of the forms of aggression that Freud warned about in that book. And, of course, he was quite right. But yes, we have to remember, yes, everybody was an appeaser in those days. And apart from in Australia, of course, a good deal of the Labour Party was completely isolationist, so they had no interest in international affairs at all. But it was really only after the occupation of Austria, and then in particular the occupation of Bohemia and Moravia in 1939, that the idea of appeasement no longer seemed to be a viable policy. But yes, Hall was an early figure warning of the consequences of appeasement. But then Hall's contribution to the larger ideas of the interwar period was strangely neglected. It's arguable, other people have constructed a slightly different lineage, but it's arguable that the Balfour Declaration, the Balfour Statement of 1926, had its origins in Hall's book of 1920, where Hall says, we're in a new era, relationship between the entities within the Empire Commonwealth is a new kind of relationship, and we need to have a clear statement of the delineation of powers of the respective parts. And, you know, this is not something that's inconsistent with the principles of the Empire Commonwealth, but we need to do this for clarity. Smuts took this idea up in 1921 at the Imperial Conference, but Hughes managed to sideline the discussions. But they came back to it in 1923 and again in 1926. And so you can argue that Hall's contribution was actually extremely important.
Another Australian's contribution at the League that flowed through to policies in Australia was that of William Caldwell.
That's right.
And his role at the International Labour Organization, and then the influence on John Curtin, Prime Minister, and his then Attorney General, Doc Evatt. Can you explain what Caldwell was doing and what his views were and why they were so important for Australian labour law?
Well, here we were. We were members of the International Labour Organization. The ILO was devoted principally to improving conditions of labour, protecting vulnerable workers and so on, and they were formulating international conventions along these lines. Australia participated in the discussions, but, of course, the state of labour law in those days in Australia was that, in many respects, it was the states who were responsible. And even though successive federal governments, having taken on board what had been discussed in Geneva, then went to the states to say, can you legislate or tell us that your legislation is already consistent? It was very, very difficult to coordinate the effort across the country. So the argument developed, and a lot of people accepted this argument, even including Sir Robert Garran, for example. The way to bind the country was to exercise the external affairs power. And that if Australia signed on to international labour conventions using that power, then the states would be bound whether they legislated or not. Now, this, of course, was to upset the then understanding of the balance that was a necessary part of federalism. So it was something of a radical suggestion. But that's the way the law, of course, has developed from that time to this. In particular, in 1936, when Caldwell was in Australia, he decided that this argument should be taken a stage further, and indeed there's some evidence suggests he even ghost wrote a very famous speech that Curtin gave on the subject. But he was also in close contact with Evatt, who he'd first met in 1926. And of course, this was the time of the famous judgment of 1936, which for the first time really, not only Evatt, but also Chief Justice Sir J.G. Latham, first formulated really clear idea that yes, external affairs power can actually bind all of the members of the Federation, irrespective of their own legislative acts on this question. So Caldwell was instrumental in advancing that argument. Of course, it was never really clearly determined until the Dams case much, much later, but it's now mainstream Australian practice. And so you can say the very first attempt to get this principle introduced can be traced back to William Caldwell. Australia's, by the way, I'm going to say, West Australia's very first Rhodes Scholar.
Oh, wow. was he? Mm. There you go. And really a piece of advice, and then, of course, became law that has huge implications for the power of the federal government.
Absolutely right.
To impose laws through treaties it signs on states and really change a lot of the
That's
dynamics between Commonwealth and state relations. Mm. In terms of how the Australian diplomats interacted with the policy of the Australian government, did you see in your research much friction there, particularly, I guess, on the issue of appeasement and how the diplomats were providing advice to government? And I appreciate the Department of External Affairs and Prime Minister of those days was tiny in comparison to what we're dealing with these days.
Well, of course, the diplomatic machine in those days was very, very small. Mm. Department of External Affairs, in fact, the term was sometimes used, but until November 1935, there was no separate department with a secretary. Even when there was a department with a secretary, there were half a dozen people in that department until 1938, 39, and then some serious recruitment got underway. So it was a tiny, tiny organisation. But interestingly enough, Caldwell, when he came to Australia, he made three trips while he was on the ILO staff. He met a number of times with Herbert Anton Peterson, who was the person working in external affairs who was in charge of ILO relations. They got on well. He thought Peterson was a supportive contact. So at that level, I think relations were quite harmonious. Caldwell also repeatedly met to Roy Hodgson, who was first assistant secretary in 1934 and then ultimately secretary of the reformed Department of External Affairs, and they seem to have got on quite well too. So at that level, I think our relations with the individuals who worked in Geneva, those relations were quite positive. Hall, though, a bit later on, was not regarded so favourably because, of course, his unhappiness about appeasement. But then, of course, this was really the parting of the ways for a lot of people. Remember that Billy Hughes actually had to leave the cabinet because he said that war was ahead, we were poorly prepared, and that even talk of peaceful steps like economic sanctions and so on, these were only just a prelude to war, they would lead to conflict, and that Australians should be advised accordingly. So there were a lot of countercurrents at that time.
And some of them eerily familiar in this day and age. Mm. The League, I mean, World War II begins in 1939, really marking the failure of the League of Nations. Why do you think it ultimately did fail? Was it really because the United States never did join?
Well, lack of American membership was a crucial factor. I mean, the Roosevelt administration actually went out of its way to cooperate with the League. And in fact, the Roosevelt administration even joined the International Labour Organization.
So the US Senate allowed that, but didn't allow, obviously.
That's right. But yes, the United States Senate has a long record for taking a progressive view of international affairs. And this record was well established even in 1920 when they were discussing the League. So their behaviour has been consistent over the years. Yes, the fact that the Americans were not members was probably the most important issue. For example, when, for a lot of people, the turning point of the League was 1931 with the Japanese invasion of Northeast China, Manchuria was then called. If the Americans had been members of the League and if there had been some economic sanctions on Japan at that time, Japanese economy was enormously vulnerable and probably Japanese aggression in China would have been checked. Had that happened, probably there would have been no Italian adventures in Ethiopia later on. So you could say American membership would have made a very great deal of difference. Also, of course, the membership of Soviet Russia would have made a difference. Of course, ultimately, Russians did become members in 1934. But yes, if the Russians had been on board earlier, that would have made quite a difference to the organisation. So lack of universality of membership is one source of its problems. But you have to remember, like the United Nations, the organisation is really no more than the will of its members. And if the state's members decide to go their own way, decide to practice self-help in security matters rather than collective security, there's not a great deal of difference the organisation can make. Right now, we're seeing similar kind of development. You've got to remember Russia is a permanent member of the Security Council and can veto any resolution put before that council if it wishes. In some ways, it's a parallel now to the situation that existed then. We haven't had a situation yet where countries have walked out of the UN. You've got to remember that, first of all, the Japanese, then the Germans, then the Italians withdrew from the League, and then a number of other countries withdrew, actually, when they could see that its prospects were increasingly problematic. We haven't reached that stage in the United Nations yet, But yes, some of the same strains are in evidence right now.
Because of the fact of the failure of the League, there would have been lessons drawn and then reflected upon when creating the United Nations in 1945. What were the failures of the League that were not repeated when forming the United Nations?
Well, of course, a lot of the institutions of the League were simply taken over. I mean, UNESCO, ILO just moved straight into the UN. Nobody hardly noticed that at one point it was a League organisation, the next minute it was part of the United Nations. And there were yet other agencies were rebadged. The Permanent Court of International Justice, the name had to be changed, but there it was, it's using the same building in The Hague, the same operations are underway. So in many ways it's simply, as I say, now League 2.0.
Rebranding.
Now League 2.0. I mean, some of the differences that the great powers now have a good deal more authority in the United Nations than they did in the League. But also, there were some situations under which, for example, resolutions of the Council had to be unanimous. And that idea was dropped in the UN, simply because, of course, any country could hold up League business, even just refusing to vote. You didn't even have to vote against it in order to bog things down in the Council. It wasn't always required to be unanimous. It was a rather complicated situation. But that problem has been avoided. But even the idea of the League mandates, this whole practice was taken over by the UN. And indeed, the rather general statements that are made in the League Covenant about the obligations of all countries to practice administrations that address the needs and welfare of the inhabitants, that idea has become a whole chapter of the United Nations Charter. And indeed, of course, after 1960 became major basis for the general critique of colonialism adopted by the UN.
It's hard to imagine member states withdrawing from the United Nations these days, but more that they would just deem it largely irrelevant to their actions. And I mean, a lot of international law is just convention rather than written out in treaties. And so as states through practice ignore the resolutions of the United Nations, the General Assembly, then does it become less and less relevant to governing the actions in international affairs?
Well, alas, that's going to be the consequence. I mean, the whole climate change issue, for example, for years and years, United Nations panels have been advancing the idea that serious policy is required. And this country, along with a lot of other countries, has really not made a great contribution. And even some of the activities of the UN along these lines have been ridiculed by Australian governments. So we didn't always make a positive contribution. Yes, international organisations are only as good as the commitment of their members.
Oh, and of course, when you have antagonism between the United States and Russia and China, United Kingdom, all of whom are permanent members of the Security Council, you also have just a basically an immovable governance structure because no one's going to see ground and nothing can really happen in terms of decision making there. It also preserves a geopolitical environment of days past, which I find interesting. So the fact that the United Kingdom is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council might have been the state of geopolitics in 1945, but fast forward to 2023, it's great from Australia's perspective that there might be other countries that would perhaps make a better case for inclusion in that body.
Yes, well, interestingly enough, the League in 1926 admitted Germany, and not only admitted Germany, but made Germany a member of the League Council because Germany was a great power, even though Germany had not been there at the foundation of the League, because the people in the League recognised that was the reality of the situation. I'm sure you're aware there have been repeated attempts to reform the UN Council, and there have been a whole host of candidates of possible members,
Japan, India, so on.
It would seem to me to have been, it might have been prudent for the European countries to have agreed to share their UN Council memberships, anomalous in the extreme, that the French are members and the British are members, the Germans are not. But that hasn't happened either. But yes, you're absolutely correct. UN requires major reform.
James Crofton, it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion on this interwar period and, of course, the contribution of Australia to the League of Nations for what it was and the legacy it leaves us. Thank you so much for joining me on our show tonight.
Oh, great pleasure, Georgina. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute. Please make sure to subscribe and catch up on our latest online content on our website or on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook.